We Made This.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Welcome to the X-Cast, the truth is in here. I am your host, Clara Cook, and today my guest is Annie. Annie, how are you today?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me on.
And is this your first ever appearance on the X-Cast?
I have done the roundtables with Marlene before, and I did one of the commentaries for Triangle with Tony, but I have never been on one of the actual episodes discussing and dissecting.
Ah, this is exciting. So you're going to actually be now an official X-Cast podcaster.
Yes. Very exciting.
You can. I feel like we should have like little like abbreviations that we can add to the end of our names, like doctor.
So what would I be then? Podcaster now? Or
like, podcaster, yeah, X-Cast, X. Just add an X to the end of your name, Annie X.
Done. I love it.
So we ask everyone who's arrived on the podcast for the first time, we ask them the five questions of X.
Oh, God. Okay.
So you ready?
I think I'm ready.
So here we go. So number one, how did you first discover the X-Files?
I was about 9 years old, and I remember all of the commercials on TV, and I thought it looked kind of cheesy, even though I was the kind of kid who would have watched Fire in the Sky. I don't know if you remember that movie. But X-Files looked lame to me. I don't know what was wrong with me. And then I didn't pay any attention. And then my cousin and one of our friends were talking about it. Oh no, you would love this show. You have to watch this show. It's so cool. It's so spooky. And I was like, okay, I don't know if you've ever seen Are You Afraid of the Dark?
So that's the kind of thing that we didn't get over here in the UK. So but I've heard of it.
Yeah. It was a kids show on Nickelodeon. And I think it aired at like 9:30 or 10. So that was super late for 9-year-old me. And anyway, they were kind of selling it. My cousin and my friend were selling it like, this is a step up from Are You Afraid of the Dark? It's so spooky. And so I was like, well, I'm in. I'm watching it. Next time, you know, next Friday, I'll watch it. And I did. And it was awesome. And I was kind of hooked ever since. And they didn't like the show, my cousin and my friend. But I became obsessed, obviously.
They knew you would like it. That's the point.
Yeah, exactly.
They made the connection between an X-Files fan, possible future X-Files fan, and the show.
That's
true. And
they
put you together. A match made in heaven. So question two, what is your favorite episode of the entire series?
I have been dreading this question because I feel... There's just so much pressure. I feel like the episode that you choose says so much about you and who you are as a person. And I feel like it's going to be dissected. But I have two. I'm going to go with a mythology episode and a non-mythology episode because they're so different. And I feel like they both kind of, not shaped me, but they both spoke a lot to me. So Anasazi for the mythology episode, like blew my mind when it came out. How was Mulder going to get out of this? And I was still at that age where I was like, they wouldn't they're going to kill the main character? Like, would they really do that? I was very naive. You know, of course they want to make money, Fox and all their associates. But that one really was amazing for me. That summer, I was on pins and needles trying to figure out what they could possibly do to get Mulder out of it. And then my non-mythology episode is going to be Bad Blood. I know it's not like the most amazing monster of the week, but it just, it's such a wonderful tribute to the fans playing off Mulder and Scully's personalities. And it's such an easy watch. You can just pop it in at any time and it's not going to depress you. And yeah, those are my two choices.
Those are both really good choices because they kind of show two of the best sides of the X-Files, don't they? Like,
yes,
this ability to tell a really amazing mythology story, but then also the sort of ability that the X-Files has to sort of poke fun at itself as well and make the audience really laugh.
And also the way that you can play with the format of the show, at least for Bad Blood.
So question three, what is your favorite season?
I'll probably go with season 5. Just so many solid episodes. And I just feel like that was peak X-Files for me.
Yeah. Also, I feel like Scully had really good hair in season 5.
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Amazing hair.
I know that I shouldn't like judge a season of a TV series on the main character's hair, but you know what I mean?
You speak the truth, though. A lot of people feel this way. Mulder had great hair in that season 2. And 4. I like season 4 hair slightly more for Mulder, but they both had top-notch hair.
And then question 4, your favorite character?
Scully. I know it's boring and everyone says it. If I had to go for a non-Mulder Scully, I would go with Krycek, just because he was fun and sexy and had so much potential and you didn't quite know what he was going to do. But Scully, she's just so inspiring and amazing and you just wanted to be her.
Yeah, I mean, the show is dominated so much by Mulder and Scully, it's kind of hard to choose anyone else.
It's really,
really
hard.
Yeah.
Unless you're Sarah Blair and...
Yeah. Unless you're going to go for a particular bald-headed man.
Exactly.
With glasses. Okay, so question 5 is your favorite moment.
It's going to be a Scully moment. And I'm going to go with Beyond the Sea when she goes in to talk to Boggs and just yells at him about flipping the switch and gassing him out of this life for good.
Yeah, that's
She's
a really
so
good
badass.
Moment.
Yeah.
Gillian Anderson really does a very good job in that episode, but especially particularly in that scene.
So good. So good. I still get chills.
Well, we're going to move on now from a moment filled with chills to an episode that I'm going to confess, the first time I tried to rewatch it, I fell asleep halfway through.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So, not so chilling. I have actually managed to watch it all the way through since then.
In preparation for this.
In preparation for this. No, I tried twice to watch it in preparation for this. First time was about 2 weeks ago and I fell asleep. The second time was in the last couple of days and I managed to get all the way through it, which is good. But I've seen this episode numerous times and I'm sure many of our listeners have as well because it is a season 6 episode. So we're going to talk about the episode Alpha. It was originally aired on March the 28th, 1999. This is the 16th episode of season 6. It's written by Jeffrey Bell and it's directed by Peter Markle. So Jeffrey Bell also wrote The Rain King. He also wrote The Goldberg Variation, which was a season 7 episode. He also wrote Signs and Wonders, which is the one that everybody will remember from having the snakes attack Mulder. And he also wrote Salvage, which was the season 8 episode. And I cannot remember Salvage at all, but the episode is directed by Peter Markle. And he's also directed Red Room, which actually aired in 2000, and A Christmas Carol, which was aired in 1997. A Christmas Carol is obviously the one where Scully meets her little daughter, Emily. Tragic story there. So a short summary of the episode. It's a series of murders is blamed on a mythical Asian dog that supposedly escaped from the US cryptologist who had caught it in Asia and was transporting it to the US. Mulder asks a reclusive female dog expert to help, which makes Scully jealous. And the IMDb rating for this episode is 6.5 out of 10. Annie, do you think that's fair?
I think it's a little high, personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think back in the day, the 90s, when I first watched it, I would have given it a 3. It really didn't stick out in my mind. I thought a lot of the Scully stuff was weird. But watching it again, I'm probably going to go with a 4.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Oh, actually, really? Okay.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought 4 out of 10. Because I don't think it's horrendous, but I definitely don't think it's as high as 6.5.
Right. It's just 6.5 is very generous.
Yeah. Well, let's see, after we've gone through the episode, scene by scene, if we still want to stick with our rating of 4, or whether or not we've gone up or down.
Okay.
But for the time being, let's take a look. Let's dig deep into this episode. So the episode opens on a ship in the Pacific, and the ship is carrying freight, and it's come from Asia. Two Chinese men, Chinese sailors, shipping employees, are examining a box that contains an animal in the cargo hold. One of them takes a closer look inside, and they see a pair of red eyes, and they hear some snarling. I think initially they are frightened that the animal in the box may have died. So the way of dealing with this is shaking the box and staring into the box.
Yeah.
Which...
so stupid, so bad.
Really stupid. I mean, even if it's not a mythical creature, it could be like a lion or... maybe not a lion, like a tiger. I don't know. Something dangerous.
Yeah, don't anger it if it's in the box. If it's still alive, it will retaliate and possibly break the box, but whatever.
The box is padlocked, and the camera pans to show that the box is quite heavily padlocked, and it shakes with the animal inside, and sort of you hear the snarling and growling. And then I think that's it. I think that's the end of the teaser. Although it pans out, doesn't it? And then it's almost like you think these men have probably ended up being attacked because they start.
Well, they open this little sliding thing to look inside. I don't know what it's officially called. And one of them says, "Oh, it's a tiger." The other one says, "Does it look like a tiger with those eyes? With those eyes, how can it be a tiger?" They look inside. There's like two glowing red eyes, which is kind of effective. It's dark and all you can see are the eyes. It's kind of creepy not knowing what it is. And then, like, I think Fong kicks the box, which is just so, so stupid.
And then they decide to open the box.
Yes. Even worse.
And then once they do, we see their shocked faces. I mean, we're talking about Jurassic Park level of stupidity here.
But they didn't even kind of like peek inside. Okay, I would have said, you hold the top of the box in case we have to slam it shut again and I'll peek inside. No, they just opened the box.
Yeah. And then we see their shocked faces. They look shocked by what they've seen in the box.
Shocked, yeah.
And horrified. And then the next scene we see is the police arriving as soon as the boat is docked in the US. And examining the cargo, and basically these two men are dead in the box. And I think that's the end of the title sequence, I think.
We see Detweiler asking for who's in charge here, saying that there is an animal inside that needs to be taken, it needs care because there's blood leaking out of the bottom of the box. And so they go to open the lid, and that's when they see...
that's when they see the two men dead right. And bloodied, yeah. And I do feel like this is quite a typical sequence for the X-Files, showing you, like teasing you at the idea of something monstrous without showing you. The X-Files is very good at doing that.
Very good, yeah. It feels very season one.
Yeah.
The way that it's executed.
And it's nice to have, I mean, instantly when Detweiler is introduced, which we'll go on to talk about Detweiler in a bit, actually, played by Andrew Robinson, who is... famous for, as we all know, playing Garak in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I mean, that's what he's mostly known for. He's a mysterious character almost immediately. He's the owner of the box, or he's the one shipping the animal over to the US from Asia. And there's just instantly something mysterious about him. I think it's the way he speaks and the way he holds himself. So that's also nice to put in the teaser, just to sort of tease on something creepy. But yeah, so what do you think of this teaser? Do you think this is, I mean, effective?
It's pretty effective. It's very season one, and I don't want to compare it too much with Shapes, which is also kind of a dog story. But it does have almost that, the very beginning when we open on the ship, that this almost like vaguely ethnic-y pan's flute music. It's varied a little bit in this, but it's very reminiscent of that. And then showing the creature without actually showing it, the two glowing red eyes. So it's okay. It's effective. I'm curious what's happening. If I didn't already know, if I hadn't already seen it, I'd say, oh, okay, two glowing red eyes. What are we going to, what are we going to encounter this week? So yeah, it's okay. I'm on board at this point.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to actually emphasize is that the two Asian characters are immediately killed off. And although this is a story about an Asian mythical creature, you don't ever meet anyone who's Asian after this.
No.
They don't consult an Asian, I don't know, a cultural specialist or a Chinese cultural specialist. None of that. So, yeah, the two, it's from Asia, and the two Asian characters are killed off immediately.
And that's it.
Yeah. So then we move on, our teaser finishes, you know, we have the credits, the classic credits, and then we get to the first scene after that, which is the FBI headquarters at 7:10 p.m. I say 7:10 p.m. because Mulder's working past 5, which a lot of people do these days, but I'm not happy to see. No work-life balance, Mulder.
But that's not unusual for him. He would take the work home with him anyway.
It's not, and we know what he's like, but I also am a little bit worried about his mental health, so... Burnout is a real thing. So Mulder's working late and he's looking at the faces of the crime scene and the pictures of the crime scene. And Scully's walking past the door and she's like, are you going to go home? And he's like, yeah, in a minute. And then he sucks her in. She's on her way home, Mulder, and you reel her back in. The interesting thing about it is that I felt in this episode they were being far too flirtatious when talking about dead people. I was like, this is not appropriate, guys. Like, she's kind of smiling at him, cocking her head at him, and then he's kind of like making dog puns. Like, I feel like they're flirting
over
photos of dead people.
Yeah.
Which they do actually routinely throughout the entire series.
I was going to say they do that. It's very run-of-the-mill, same old, just another day on the job for them.
So here's a question for you. Are animal bites scary? Are they scary or are they not scary? Are dogs scary or are they not scary? Because at this point, I find the idea that two men are dead and locked in a box more freaky than the idea of two men being killed by a dog.
So dog bites are scary, but I'm not afraid of being killed by one. It would never cross my mind. Like, I was on the lawn one day and a dog off leash ran up to me and started barking and growling at me. But I was afraid I'd get bitten, but not afraid that I'd die. So, yeah.
It's like a mortal fear. It's more like
X-Files level scary.
I think that's one of the things I think this problem with this episode is that the premise of the idea of a dog, a killer dog, is just not threatening enough on, you said, on X-Files level.
But they can be scary because there's Cujo, and that's a much scarier movie and book than this episode is.
That's true.
So execution, maybe it's not quite the premise, but the execution of this episode.
So next we're at the beautifully named Bellflower, California, which a lovely name for an area. And an official, who I think is like a customs official, comes out of his house because his golden retriever is barking at a silhouette of a large dog on the other side of his garden fence.
And I thought that silhouette was actually pretty effective as well. It looked big and menacing. It worked really well.
It looks more wolf-like, really, than anything else, doesn't it? More like a wolf. The official, whose name is Jake, I'm going to name him Jake, goes to investigate and sees he takes his golden retriever, who's called Jojo, puts his golden retriever back in the house, and you know the golden retriever Jojo is barking away, and he sees the dog's shadow and then goes to look for the dog, but then when he looks over the fence, the dog is gone. So what do you think of this scene? Did you think this scene was effective? I mean I kind of could see what was going to happen, even though I've seen the episode before. It's a lot of sort of setting it up that, you know, he's going to go back into the house, the dog will be in the house.
And... Right. Well, first, I noticed all the dog treats out. This man is a dog owner. That's what they're telling us. Dog treats everywhere, on top of the fridge, on the counter. I was like, who just leaves their stuff out? I guess if you're maybe a bachelor and you don't care about cleaning up, I don't know. But that was the first thing I noticed, was all the dog treats. This man they're telling us, loves his dog. And it was sad. I didn't want to see JoJo die. JoJo didn't do anything to anyone. Seemed like a really good dog, obedient, but a little lame. I don't know. Going through the motions, predictable, just didn't really strike fear into the hearts of many.
So one of the things that I read was that Jeffrey Bell, who wrote the episode, was inspired to write the episode by seeing a pack of wild dogs near LA. And that, I felt, was a more frightening idea. Like, I think he was either driving or walking, but he saw a pack of wild dogs near a motorway in LA. And I thought, wild dogs in LA? Like, are there packs of wild dogs that, like, roam the countryside near LA or roam California? That seems like an even more scary idea than this random dog, you know, going around and killing people. There's also no indication of why this dog is killing, you know? And I mean, I know it's a mystery, but as we will go on talk about later in the episode, we never really have a clear answer to why this particular creature kills the people it kills.
Well, I think it's interesting that he settled on this particular story because there were two earlier scripts from my research, and the initial story was based on a movie called The Incredible Journey. It was, I think, the inverse of it. So a family moves away from a house to escape a killer dog. And when they come to their new home, they find their dog there, which sounds way cooler and way more interesting, I think, than just kind of these, like, random people being attacked throughout Los Angeles. It's not that they're not connected, because they all kind of, like, vaguely work together. But as you said, no motivation. This would have been clear motivation. My, you know, the family left me and I'm going out to get them. And that seems way cooler. And then the second one was about an angry child who releases his anger through the dogs at a local animal shelter, which I'm not quite sure about that one, but interesting. So I think it's strange that they have settled on this particular story, and I don't know why.
There's possibilities for this story to work, but
sure,
it falls down in several areas, and definitely motivation is one of them,
yeah,
I feel.
Agreed.
You struggle to understand the motivation of almost any of the characters in this entire episode. I mean, even to the point where you struggle to understand the motivation of Mulder and Scully. I mean, Mulder, I guess he's always interested in a paranormal mystery, right? But Scully just seems kind of bored throughout the entire thing. She doesn't even seem to care that people are dying.
No.
Which normally Scully would, you know, so.
I think both David and Gillian are lacking a certain energy in this one.
Yeah, yeah. Which is probably because it isn't brilliantly written.
Sure.
So then we're back at the port, where Mulder and Scully are investigating the two dead gentlemen in the box. And they meet Officer Jeffrey Kahn. So it's worth noticing Jeffrey Kahn, because he's played by Thomas F. Duffy. And Thomas F. Duffy, some of you will recognise, is the paleontologist from Jurassic Park, The Lost World, who gets eaten by a T-Rex.
Oh,
so, yeah, so I this guy know. is playing characters that routinely get eaten by other animals.
Hmm. So, what a career choice. Typecasting. I mean,
And then we find out the animal was being shipped to the US from Asia by a cryptozoologist called Dr. Ian Detweiler, which is an interesting name. I know that he was called Detweiler because I think the writer named him after a person in a band that he was a fan of. But Detweiler sounds like a dog name. Detweiler sounds like a name, a really pretentious name that somebody might give a German shepherd. But also Detweiler is very close to Rottweiler. So I immediately was like, what a great name for a cryptozoologist who is supposedly not connected to the dog except by owning it. So, Annie, do you know what a cryptozoologist is?
No, I'm like Mulder. You'll probably have to explain it to me.
a cryptozoologist is an expert in a pseudoscience that, cryptozoology, which is a pseudoscience that aims to prove the existence of creatures or entities from folklore, such as Bigfoot, the Yeti, and the Chupacabra. You know what I mean, that goat sucking thing in Mexico.
El Chupacabra.
El Chupacabra, thank you.
Sure.
And cryptozoology is not considered a real science by scientists, like by other scientists, but it is considered a field of study because, you know, I mean, there are cryptozoology groups that you can belong to, and, you know, here we have Detweiler, who's an actual professor or doctor, qualified doctor in cryptozoology.
Did you love how Mulder perked up at the mention of cryptozoologist? Like, oh, this is where I come in. Thank you.
Yes, then he starts rifling off different mythical creatures, and yes. Scully's just like, he's going to go on for a while. Just like...
just excuse him, it's fine.
Just let him. I just have this feeling of like, you know, I could just imagine Mulder like wandering off into the distance, just mumbling to himself.
Yes.
Like Bigfoot, Yeti, Loch Ness Monster. So then Detweiler turns up. Now, I felt this was really sloppy writing, which it's like, you know, it's like as if, you know, I said, so, Tony has written a book. And you said, yeah, Tony's written a book. Let's talk about Tony for a couple minutes. And then suddenly Tony jumps on the Zoom call. It's like, hey, fancy seeing you here. You know, like, it's like you talk about somebody and then suddenly they appear. And I felt like this was pretty sloppy writing, to be honest. It's like enter stage left, Detweiler.
I felt it's kind of like elbow, nudge, nudge, get it? He's the one. Get it? Detweiler, here he is. He's the one you're looking for. It was a little too much, yeah.
I mean, I think almost immediately it's pretty much signposted, even if it's not deliberate signposting, that Detweiler is either lying, knows more than he's saying, or actually is the monster himself.
Yeah, it's a little obvious right from the get-go. Yeah. And he doesn't act suspicious at all.
And it doesn't help that Andrew Robinson, I mean, I don't know, he's got sort of like a sort of spooky quality to him. Do you know the way that he acts? He kind of has this sort of very unblinking stare,
yes.
which he uses to great effect later on. And you sort of just sort of feel like, by all accounts, he is an absolutely delightful individual. But when he's acting, you know, he's... I would say intense, and
yes,
he doesn't seem like a very sort of kind of like gentle, approachable kind of character in this show.
Right.
So immediately you're suspicious of him. So Detweiler tells Mulder and Scully that the animal was stolen and it's a valuable rare creature called a Wangshang doll, which is, sorry, apologies to anybody about my pronunciation there, a canid from Asia. And Mulder somehow knows exactly how long this dog has been extinct for. He's like, oh, yeah, the Wangshang doll. That one.
Expected of Mulder, though. He knows these things. This is his field of expertise.
I mean, I was amazed. I was like, wow, Mulder's like, Mulder must have like a mind palace where he keeps all this information.
Yes.
I would ask, is any of this plausible? Like anything in this entire scene
no.
is plausible?
The scene doesn't work. Like you said, Detweiler comes in right when they're talking about him. The story that Detweiler tells the dogs or the men who have died of the dog bites, but he swears it's not his. It just seems silly and not well written, not well thought out.
So then Mulder and Scully show up at Bellflower, and then Mulder does a few more dog puns and dog jokes.
Can I just make an observation? As soon as we get to this crime scene, Mulder steps over dog poop. I don't know if you noticed that.
I didn't.
So
see
we
that,
know no. there was a dog here. He found the poop.
So Mulder hypothesizes that the dog is not really a dog and that the dog is behaving more like a human or a dog with human intelligence. And you can well understand what Scully thinks of this.
She is skeptical.
Now, one thing to point out to the audience is Karen Berquist is played by Melinda Kulea, who just also happens to be married to the director, Peter Markle. So Karen Berquist is a dog behaviour expert. She runs a kennel. They enter her house, which I think is actually kind of a nice house. It's like a wood paneled house. Like it's got like sort of comfy stuff in it. It's got a lot of like plants and everything. But Scully immediately seems kind of disgusted by it. She says something like, is this woman a bat expert?
It is very dark in the house. No lights are on. None of the windows are open. So it's dark. I get that. Can I just say that this house reminds me so much of Shapes because it's all wood, very cozy, almost that like that Twin Peaks feel. I feel like, I don't know if it was an intentional callback to that episode, but it really, really reminded me of like that woodsy feel. From Shapes. Yeah, so Scully makes that bat joke. And I kind of get it. It's dark in there, but I also kind of like it dark in my house sometimes. And especially if I'm not in the room, who cares? So a little strange that Scully would make that observation.
Like, before she's even met Karen, well, we'll go on to talk about this, but she's judging her, mocking her, and is kind of, I would say, on the attack. So Karen, so Mulder explains to us who Karen is. She's a dog expert, and she's lived with wild dogs and wolves on 5 continents, which I thought was an amazing piece of information, because I was like, wow, like, that is kind of insane.
Very intense. That's an intense love.
But Mulder's never met her, and he's just had correspondence with her, and he's read some of her books, and she recommended the case to him. Now, I think one of the things that's quite interesting here is that he never explained to Scully that this case was referred to him from Karen.
Not unlike Karen. Mulder, to keep things purposefully or not.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it just slipped his mind, but I can't think of a reason for why he would deliberately keep this from Scully, except that maybe Scully would be like, is there a crazy person emailing you? Do we have to go off all the way out to California just because a crazy person's emailing you? So maybe he was like, I don't want to have this conversation, so I'm just not going to mention Karen. And one of the things that you notice is that Karen also owns I Want to Believe poster. And Mulder doesn't have one now, right? Because mm-hmm. It was destroyed.
It was burned up in the end. The episode. Yeah, the end.
So the best part of this little part of the episode is that Karen enters with like 6 different dogs, and they're all different shapes and sizes. And some of them are fluffy and small.
They're so cute.
They're so cute.
You counted 6. I only got 5.
Or maybe there was 5.
I could be wrong. Like, I wasn't sure.
I was like, she's got her own little motley pack of dogs. And I kind of like Karen for that reason.
Okay.
I was like, she's got plants in her house, you know. So Karen is a little odd. That's one of the things to notice. She calls Mulder Fox immediately, which I don't know if that is so odd, because I think that most people call each other by their first names. It's just Scully and Mulder are odd,
right,
calling each other by their last names. And she also stays away from the light. She turns down the blinds, and she, you know, kind of moves away from the light. And she's dressed in like dark clothing, and she's covered up completely. And she's not adept at interacting with people. It's quite obvious. Like, she doesn't always make eye contact with Mulder and Scully. She's not very good at conversing with people. What do you think of Karen?
She's like your eccentric, not your eccentric aunt, but someone's eccentric aunt.
I do have an eccentric aunt.
So do I. So she's interesting. She walks in. She doesn't say hello to them at all. She, you know, the dogs run in, and she's a little off-putting, I would say, not very warm. I think it's strange that she wonders why they're there, though she's the one who has told Mulder about this. That I thought was a little odd. There's clearly not something wrong with her. That's not what I mean to say. She's an introvert. These social situations seem to make her uncomfortable. And on a certain level, I can sympathize with her, though I do think it's odd that she doesn't even say hello. It's very to the point. I forget exactly what her first words were to them, but it wasn't like, hi, how are you? Can I help you here today? Or it's a little odd.
Yeah, I sort of feel like she's communicating with them, or she's like, I don't know, sending them signals using her body language. But
yes,
not conversing with them, which is actually very animal-like. Like, it's very, you know, I mean, one of the things that is really important to understand about dogs and cats is that they communicate. We hear them bark and meow and everything, but that's a tiny part of their communication. They communicate using their bodies, using body language.
Right, that's a great observation, yeah.
And so I feel like a little bit like she spent so much time around dogs that she's verbalizing her thoughts and talking to other people, something that she's not practiced at doing and not very good at doing and probably doesn't enjoy doing. What surprises me as well also is that, I don't know, I mean, I feel like Mulder and Scully have met so many interesting people by this point, and that Scully's a scientist, Mulder's a sort of expert in psychology supposedly, and both of them seem confused by her, and, you know, it's not like they're meeting her at a dinner party.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, so I think that their reaction to her is a bit odd. I feel like that they would be they're acting like they're the audience, like they're us.
Right.
We know that they know more than us about stuff like this.
And Scully, maybe not Mulder, but Scully in the past has shown that she is very good with people who might not be as comfortable opening up. And she can be quite an empathetic person and doesn't show that in this episode at all.
Yeah, she says very little empathy. Maybe right. A little bit of empathy at the very end. But by that point, right. It's kind of too late.
Right.
Now, what did you think of this scene? It's steamy, it's dark, it's misty in the basement.
I thought it was great. I thought this was one of the more effective scenes in this episode. The steam, even when he's coming down, we know he's not the threat. But it gives you the sense you can't see what's happening. You don't know what's going to happen. Who's out there? Is there someone watching him? From our perspective where we are, you're not quite sure. And he walks down the steps and he walks closer towards the camera. And it looks really cool. I thought they did an amazing job here. It was a great use of this set. And then later when he turns around, he sees someone walking towards him. And again, that's also very effective.
I agree with you. This scene is probably one of the more effective ones in the entire episode. So a while later, Mulder and Scully show up at the crime scene. Karen says that the dog is displaying dominant alpha behavior, so that sort of the behavior that the top dog would exhibit, being territorial, attacking to dominate. Mulder thinks that the animal's motivations are more complicated, that it's tricking its victims, and it does sort of seem like the dog is actually tricking its victims into coming down into a basement, into kind of going out into the garden, then going back into the house. It does seem like, or opening up the box, you know, in the first scene of the episode, that the dog is sort of tricking the victims into putting themselves into a position of peril where the dog has the upper hand. She seems to think that dogs are better than humans.
Yeah.
She acts like that.
Well, her book was named Better Than Human. So she definitely thinks that dogs are better than human.
And she seems to want to, like, she doesn't seem like she's not in favor of killing this dog or anything. Like,
right.
It's not, you know, she wants to kind of save it, protect it. And then Karen and Dr. Detweiler meet. Their eyes cross paths. Mm-hmm. Their eyes meet across this steamy basement room with a dead guy because he's also shown up. Now, first of all, Karen showing up is kind of odd anyway. Like, Mulder didn't ask her to come to the crime scene. But Dr. Detweiler showing up at a crime scene, when he says that his dog is not killing anybody, if he keeps showing up at crime scenes, everyone's going to think, your dog is killing people. Like,
my dog didn't do it. I'm just here to observe. No big deal. Yeah.
And they dislike each other on sight, basically. Or they sort of, there's a recognition there. She doesn't like the look of him. He seems kind of horrified by her, or at least shocked. So what is going on there? Is that some sort of supernatural connection here? Or could she sniff out a dog man? Or what's going on?
I don't know. And I don't know if it's ever really explained. There is some sort of recognition there, though.
Do you think that's a good thing to put in the episode? Or do you think it just makes it a little bit hokey?
If there's payoff in the end, I think it could be interesting. If there's payoff in the end, I stress.
It is also sort of amusing to see these two completely odd characters that everyone realizes kind of odd. Sort of not maybe recognize the oddness in each other, but not kind of, you know, they're not going to, there's no indication that either of them are going to band together to try and find this dog and save this dog. That's, you know, not even.
I think it would be interesting if they kind of do pit them against each other in the end, but not in any meaningful or successful way. But they are dog lovers, or at least animal lovers, and they kind of have different goals here. And it would be a really interesting either team up, as you said, or, you know, they could be really good adversaries, and it never really strikes a balance either way.
I thought a nice twist would be if Karen sort of leads Mulder and Scully to believe that she's going to help them, but then at the 11th hour decides to save the dangerous dog.
Right.
And basically condemn the humans. But, yeah, we don't get that.
Right.
So I felt this was the point where you truly get to see that what a good villain Andrew Robinson could be. He's sort of got that, like I said before, that kind of glassy stare where his eye, he sort of seems to be staring, but sort of like he's like almost like he's staring into the distance, like this unblinking stare, and he just this very sort of like kind of like face. And that's the problem with podcasting, you can't see the face I'm making,
right?
But but I feel that the episode doesn't utilize him as much as it could. It kind of wastes him as an actor, and I feel like this is the point where you see how creepy a villain he could have been if the story had been better and he'd been given more to work with.
I 100% agree with you that this is an effectively creepy, aggressive stare. The thing that I really like about Andrew Robinson is his nuance in acting. And I felt like, A, he wasn't really given enough to do, as you said, but there was no nuance really to this character. It was mostly just aggressive. Aggressively searching for the dog and aggressively staring at Khan. But he's just such a great actor. It could have been, there could have been more mystery, I guess. And you don't really get that. You just get, as you said, the main suspect not even halfway through the episode. So that was a bit of a disappointment. But he's a great actor. It's not his fault. I'm not saying that this was him. The writing or a combination of the writing and the directing, it just didn't work for me.
I mean, obviously we're watching this episode now, having seen it before, so we know what the story is going to be. When you first watched this episode, if you can remember, did you feel that Detweiler was basically the main protagonist, like the main villain?
I don't remember. It was a long time ago, and I think I mostly felt bored. I'm sorry. If I'm being honest, I just remember being very underwhelmed by this episode when I first watched it. So.
No, I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, accurate, to be honest. Right. So. But I do feel that they sort of red flag Detweiler almost immediately in the beginning of the episode. And it's just one red flag after another gets planted on top of him. Till eventually he's just one giant mass of red flags.
He's always there at every crime scene. And he's not an investigator. And if he doesn't think his dog is doing it, why is he there? He should be off somewhere else in Los Angeles looking for his dog.
And I also don't understand why Mulder and Scully don't keep asking, what is this guy doing?
Right.
Why does he keep showing up every single time we find a dead person? So then we go to Karen and Mulder and Scully. Oh, they're in her office. And she said that she's found animal tracks. And then they do that typical thing they do on TV shows. Where
I
like,
love this 90s enhancement. I love it.
It's a blurred photo. So if we zoom in, it's not going to be more pixelated and more blurred. It's going to somehow sharpen. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, it's like, it's basically science fiction, let's be honest.
If it had been the Lone Gunman or Mulder and Scully doing this at FBI labs somewhere, yes. Karen Berquist is doing this in her home on her regular home computer. Bullshit. Am I allowed to say that?
Well, you have now already, okay. So.
Well, I can say bull. I can say bull crap, but.
Bull crap? Dog crap.
Dog crap. Dog crap, damn it. That's just. Like, why does she have this equipment? Who is she? Is she going to crime scenes exonerating dogs all over the world? I mean,
I guess you could say that she's looking at dog prints on a regular basis for her research.
Could be. Yeah, that's a good point.
Both Karen, and this is a really funny bit, which I actually laughed at. So they're zooming in and Mulder's like, let's have a little look closer or whatever. And both Karen and Mulder touch the mouse at the same time. She's got her hand on the computer mouse. And Mulder touches her hand. And then Scully just like fixates on their hands together on the mouse. And Karen looks at him because maybe he's a little bit too close. I don't know. Maybe she's like, oh, the touch of another person's hand. But Scully's reaction is really, really odd. It's really weird. It's like, I mean, it's not a romantic gesture. He's just clicking on the mouse to move it because he wants to see something. I mean, there must be a million. I mean, and earlier in the episode, Scully, like Mulder, I think he's talking to Scully in Karen's house and he sort of touches her back. Do you notice that? Like, I feel like Mulder's quite a tactile person anyway.
Yes.
I feel like on a regular basis, Mulder must end up touching people. This sounds really dodgy. But you know what I mean? Like, he's probably like, you know, he pats someone on the shoulder or he, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, sort of shake someone's hand or it's not something that's romantic. And this
but
is
I don't
obviously
think
not
their hands actually touch. He just kind of, I think he touches the side of the mouse and moves it over to where he wants it to go. I don't think they actually ever touch.
Which, means there's no reason at all for Scully to be. She's like, they're just too close.
Yeah.
My man and the dog woman is just too close to each other. I mean, some people could say there's a parallel here between, you know, territorial dog killing creature and territorial Scully. But I don't know if the episode is smart enough to make parallels.
Right. Like, well, yes, they're setting Scully up to try to become the alpha here, I think. But I kind of look at this episode through the lens of like watching the entire sixth season. And I feel like a lot of the jealousy isn't directed at Karen, but it has more so to do with Diana Fowley. Because Two Fathers, One Son happened, I don't know, 4 or 5 episodes back. And I try to view it through that scope, through that lens, that like we have this whole season of Diana happening. And Scully can't really do anything about Diana, but she can do something about Karen. Karen does not actually pose a threat. I don't know if that was intentional, but that's how I view it. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's possible that she's frustrated because, you know, like you said, they've been, I mean, especially in season 6, they hint a lot at like a relationship or a possible attraction or relationship between Mulder and Scully. I mean, it's hinted at throughout the entire seasons of all the series, you know, all seasons of all, the entire series, but especially in season 6. And so it also could be like a certain level of frustration as well. You know, like, why is Mulder conversing with this woman on the internet? Why didn't he talk about her? You know, it's maybe she senses that Karen is a bit of a, I don't know, sort of obsessive loner in the way that Mulder is. Maybe that's something that Scully isn't, that she can't. I'd say at this point, Scully is pretty obsessive. But, like, you know, maybe, like, you know, she doesn't feel like she can sort of relate to Mulder on the same level that Karen does. But, like, we have to read into that. We have to read into the episode to find that. That is not something that they are telling us or portraying us to us. If Scully showed some vulnerability that she was like, you know, I feel like you have this connection to this woman that I can't share with you. Well, even if she didn't say it like that, that would be more, I think that would make more sense than this sort of random jealousy that seems to come out of nowhere. Also, the other thing I would say is, if they want to make a parallel between the alpha, like, what's it called? Wan Shang Dol. If they want to make a parallel between the alpha, like, territorial behavior of the Wan Shang Dol and Scully's territorial behavior of Mulder, then they should have made the Wan Shang Dol female.
Right. Well, that would have been interesting,
Wolf packs are run by a matriarch. Wolf society is dominated by females. Yeah, there's an alpha male, but it's the alpha female that's the one that's in charge. She's the one that bears the litter of puppies, the fox cubs or whatever, that's not fox cubs, sorry, wolf cubs that are brought up and everything. So in wolf society, like, it's the females who are in charge. So I wonder how different this episode would have been if Dr. Detweiler had been a woman. And not that I want Andrew Robinson to be out of a job, because he's a great actor. But that, then you could have made more parallels, I think,
right,
between the two. There's just not enough of a connection between the Wan Shang Dol and Scully's behavior in order for that to.
It's very forced. You know what I
mean? Yeah,
it's very forced. And I'm, as much as it makes me uncomfortable the way she's acting, the mean things that she's saying, I don't think she's quite crossed the line yet. It's like, okay, I'm a little uncomfortable, but whatever. She's pissed about Diana. Let's just roll with it. Again, my headcanon. She's mad about Diana, so she's acting out here. But it doesn't feel earned.
Karen thinks that the creature could possibly open doors, which I was like, dude, it has to be able to open a door. How can it get in and out of a room? But anyway, Scully challenges her again. So they're having a sort of a debate about it now. And Scully is used to challenging people and questioning people, but she does it a little bit aggressively here because obviously she's unhappy with Karen. And Karen says the Wan Shang Dol can be an evil creature in Chinese myth. Just yet again highlights how an utter lack of Chinese culture there is in this whole episode. You know, which, you know, fair enough, they're not in China, they are in America, and, you know, I presume everyone who was Chinese on the freighter has. So Karen says there may be some truth behind the myth. And I think what she's saying there is not that there's a literal dog that is stealing people's wives, but that maybe the behaviour of the creature, you know, is the fact that maybe it's a bit of an escape artist, or it's very hard to find, it's elusive, can, you know, be linked to the idea of it disappearing, that maybe the creature's behavior is what inspired, because there often is truth to myths, it's just not word for word what the myth is saying, you know, like, you know, like an ecological event could lead to a myth about something, or, you know, lightning, you know, people made up myths about, you know, a god having power over lightning, you know, like, it's like this, myths are sort of an explanation for how people interpret the world around them without knowledge of science, I suppose. So, you know, there's definitely some possible truth in that. Scully then abruptly leaves. She's disgusted, and she goes, she leaves the room, and later asks, well, she goes and sits in the car outside, which is a real sulky behavior of like, I'm going to go sit in the car.
Is she 13? What is this?
So then Mulder goes and joins in the car afterwards, and she says that she asks Mulder how he found out about the case. She asks him a little bit about Karen, and then she says she thinks that Karen enticed Mulder out to California just to meet him. And Mulder's like, yeah, really? Like, he's, you know, he's like, well, as flattered as I am, like, I don't think that's what's going on here, or whatever he says.
I'm thinking, who wouldn't try to get Mulder out to California to meet them? Yeah, Scully, I get it.
Also, I feel a little bit like this kind of, it utterly forgets the issue of the fact that people have died.
Right.
So regardless of what Karen's motivations are, they need to be there anyway, right? Because mm-hmm. it's a paranormal event in which people have died. That's, Mulder would do that anyway.
Yep.
And there's a mystery to solve, and the mystery isn't whether or not Karen likes Mulder. The mystery is, how do we find this dog and prevent more people from dying?
Right.
Scully doesn't seem in any way concerned about that.
Whatever conversation they're having in the car right now, they can have later at home, in the office,
yeah,
wherever. It doesn't need at to home. Happen right now, because they are in the middle of an investigation.
So Scully is then jealous, and she says this horrible line that I hate, and I want to slap, I want to reach into the TV screen and slap her, says, don't underestimate a woman, they can be tricksters too. Which is, I feel like, it feels sexist thing to me, the idea that women are out there, like, manipulating and tricking men, which, I mean, I'm sure women do trick men, but men also trick women, men trick other men, and women trick other women, like, it's not some, being a trickster isn't a gendered thing,
right?
Like, and I don't like that, because that's the whole, like, deep-rooted male fear that women are going to be manipulating me and making me do something against my will, you know, whereas, you know, nah.
Again, I don't like this line. I truly feel like it is directed at Diana. This is not about Karen. Again, in my head canon, she has this aggression towards Diana and whatever's been happening. There's nothing to warrant this level of suspicion about Karen, other than she's a little odd, antisocial. She touched a mouse at the same time as Mulder. There's nothing to warrant Scully's level of alpha behavior.
Also, what does Scully, I mean, I know that probably the listeners are like, you're going into this too much, but also, what does Scully think's going to happen? Like, that Mulder's going to fall in love with Karen and move to California?
Forget the X-Files, he's done.
Yeah, live in a kennel with a bunch of dogs, yeah, and a woman who, like, lives in, like, is basically lives inside a house and never goes out. Like, I mean, Mulder might have a connection to Karen that he doesn't have with Scully, in the sense that they're both, like, these unusual people who are obsessive and loners and everything. But, like, I mean, look at Scully, man. You know, all the things that he's done with Scully, all the times he's proven his devotion to her. And also, she's really attractive. Like, not saying that Karen isn't attractive, but, like, Scully, jeez. Then later on, there's a scene, like, just after that, where the veterinary surgery is closed and the vet is going through the back of the building where all the dogs are in their cages. And one of the questions is, the vet says, how did Duke get back into the veterinary surgery when he was taken away by his owner?
Interesting.
Yeah. But this also leads this throws another thing into the mix, which we'll talk about in just a second. Which the X-Files sometimes does this, where they've got a paranormal premise, right? And that premise, you know, that fits a number of paranormal rules. And then halfway through the episode, they give this creature another paranormal power. And you're like, what? it kind of takes you away from the story and kind of takes you out of the story and sort of makes it disjointed,
right,
and reminds you that you're watching an episode of The X-Files rather than being in the story. So it's just another thing in a long line of things in this episode that don't make logical sense.
Right.
You know, which brings you out of the episode, mm-hmm, I think, when you're watching it.
Before we move on, did you notice that as Scully enters the clinic, the vet hospital, she finds a signed picture from Karen Berquist?
Oh, no, I didn't.
On the wall, there's a signed picture. And I don't know what the point of this picture was. It doesn't ever mean anything for the story.
She's a famous dog expert, right?
I guess.
Someone with an autographed photo.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed random and out of nowhere and not important to the story at all, but Scully noticed it.
Does she spit at it?
Almost.
Knock it off the wall.
Get out of here.
Yeah, bitch! I mean, Scully must feel like she's seeing Karen everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, I can't get rid of this woman.
For someone that never leaves the house.
She's everywhere.
Okay, so next we see Scully go to meet Karen. And this is a really uncomfortable scene. I think you probably, what you were going to say earlier in the episode, you probably will probably want to be saying it now, because she goes to confront Karen and she diagnoses her with lupus and then seems unsympathetic about the fact that Karen has lupus. She sort of says, like, you know, Karen says it's a coincidence that she's, you know, like lupus is, you know, obviously linked to the word wolf. And then Scully says, a coincidental or perverse or something. I don't know. She's just really unsympathetic. And for a medical doctor, I felt this was really not right.
Right.
She claims that Karen lured Mordor out to California. And then she says, I'm watching you. Which, I was like, Jesus, Scully.
So uncalled for. So there are a lot of things that I find strange with this particular scene. Number one, she's in Karen's house, but she's sitting alone in Karen's office, I guess. It doesn't say how she was let in. I assume it was the person who let them in the first time, but it doesn't say that. So it just seems kind of weird. She doesn't like go up to the door and knock, right? She's just already in the house when you get to the scene.
She just walks in.
Right. And she's waiting for Karen to come in again. Okay, fine. And she confronts Karen out of nowhere about her lupus and luring Mulder out here. And is this the scene where she says that, where Karen says that she lacks Scully's feminine wiles?
Yeah.
That seems also strange. And, you know, if I were Karen, I'd say none of your business. There was this case and I called him out here.
He's an expert in this stuff.
Like, I just don't understand everything that happens in this scene. And this, for me, is absolutely where Scully crosses the line. Before, it was like, okay, Scully's a little bit jealous. It's uncomfortable. But we've seen Scully act kind of strange with other women before. So it's not completely uncalled for. Is it now canon that Scully's a jealous person? Is this what they were going for? I'm not really sure. But it adds attention to the story that I feel is weird and not warranted, at least in this particular episode. So even Karen's reaction, instead of telling her to get lost, she just says, yeah, I'm just not, I lack your feminine wiles. What can I say? I didn't know how else to get him out here. Like, that's weird too. I don't know.
Yeah, so I feel that this is probably going to cause a bit of controversy amongst some of our listeners, but I feel that this particular conversation is how women do not talk to each other this way. I'm not saying women don't argue with each other. I'm not saying women don't bitch with each other. But I feel like, or bitch at each other, or manipulate each other, or backstab each other. Plenty of that goes on. But this is just not a conversation that women would have with each
no.
other. It's not accurate. It's not realistic. Especially two women that don't know each other very well. And one of the reasons why I say this is this whole scene screams to me a man writing what he thinks female jealousy is.
Yeah.
You know, and that he's getting completely wrong. Which I'm not saying that the writer didn't understand women, but he doesn't understand them in this scene. I also feel that if they're going to make Scully jealous, then they've got to admit in the series that Scully's in love with Mulder. Or at least very strongly attracted to him. And they're still, at this point in the series, in season six, they're still playing with that, like, right, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, at times Scully seems uninterested. At times Mulder seems uninterested. At times they seem very interested. Sometimes they're properly hinted at it. In some episodes, it's almost very explicitly said that they're in love with each other. But I'm thinking, like, you can't have it both ways. You can't have them have this unresolved tension and, you know, tiptoe around each other for the next 10 years of, right, television or whatever. But also have Scully be really super jealous of a woman that Mulder has shown no interest in.
Like, right.
No interest whatsoever. So it's you know, sloppy writing, you know. So you can't be like, people are shipping from nowhere, and then, but at the same time, have Scully be incredibly jealous. Like, Scully, if you're this jealous about it, do something about it. Ask Mulder on a date. Like,
Chris Carter wanted it both ways, and he played with it for as long as he could, even to the point where it got ridiculous.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Where you don't buy it anymore.
I feel like this element of the story has been put in here to create tension for tension's sake.
Right.
And there's other ways you could have created tension. Like, you could have had an animal rights activist fighting for the right for this murderous creature to survive. You could have had a cultural clash between American ideas about animals and Chinese ideas about animals. I don't know, because it's a Chinese mythical creature. You know, there's a whole range. You could have talked the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of thing, a man, a sensible, rational man, and the animal side of him. You know, there's a whole range of ways you could have made this story filled with much more tension and drama than to have Scully be jealous of basically an invalid who has, like, sort of socializing, like, social issues.
Right.
Socializing issues. That's not the right way of putting it. Like, basically
social anxiety.
Social anxiety, right. Yeah. Who's also got, like, a life-threatening disease. Because lupus isn't a joke. It's definitely a very serious illness.
Yeah, which is why it seems so out of character for Scully.
She's like, Karen, did you get lupus deliberately?
Just to get Mulder out here.
Just to be a bit more dog-like. Like,
also, imagine how Mulder would feel if he had found out about this conversation, which he doesn't, and that's fine, but it wouldn't reflect well on Scully.
And also, it's kind of interfering with the case.
Right.
So, and often in times in the episodes, their personal feelings about things do interfere with the case. That's one of the reasons why the X-Files are so dramatic. But this is a really stupid thing to interfere with the case.
Right. In Irresistible, her personal feelings interfered with the case because she was scared for her life and it really affected her. This one, she's jealous. I really feel like season six is the season of jealousy for Scully, and it's unbecoming of her. It's not the strong, badass Scully that we love so much.
And also, there's a very important point in this scene where Karen says that she doesn't think Detweiler actually caught the creature. And if Detweiler didn't catch the creature, then how is the creature in America? If he didn't catch the creature, then he has to be the creature. So, you know.
I believe when Karen says that, Scully just replies that she's watching Karen. She completely ignores what she said about the investigation. Which is crazy.
It's like you're watching the wrong person.
Yeah.
And while Officer Khan is talking to Mulder over the police radio, Mulder says, like, meet me, we're going to go to a lab, we're going to look at the sort of tranquilizer.
I actually thought this was done pretty well. So Khan is outside. He gets a call through the dispatcher, but Khan come in, and he's not responding to this emergency call. And I thought that was really cool. That was good tension built up until he finally answers. You think that maybe he's been attacked, maybe something has happened to him, and then they patch him, or he answers, they patch Mulder through, and you know that everything's okay with Khan. So I did feel for this guy at this point.
They sort of release attention, mm-hmm, so that you're kind of unaware. You're kind of like in a place of calmness,
right,
before they hammer it home that this guy actually is going to die.
Right.
Like, oh no, he's going to die. He's dead. Oh no, he's not dead. Oh, Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, he is dead.
But it was very effective.
Because that means it's more of a surprise mm-hmm. when he gets in the car and realizes that he sees in the rearview mirror that the Wanchan doll is in the back of the car.
Yeah.
So Mulder shows up at the hospital where Detweiler is sitting beside Officer Khan, who's in the bed, unconscious. And, you know, right away you're like, why on earth is Detweiler sitting at Officer Khan's bedside?
Why is he showing up everywhere? That's odd. Like, how did you know about this?
I feel like these coincidences were or not coincidences, but I thought this was so obvious. I feel like any other investigator would have solved this. And I was thinking Sherlock Holmes would have solved this about an hour ago. And Mulder then challenges Detweiler. And there's a nice little scene where Mulder basically grabs Detweiler by the arm and yanks him away from the bedside. And then says, and then he names Karen, which I think is really stupid. As in, like, Karen is onto you, mm-hmm. which makes Karen a target right away, saying she knows what happened.
That seems very sloppy of Mulder.
But it's a plot device, isn't it? They have to set Karen up as a threat. Obviously. Because we've been told repeatedly that dogs don't commit murder, and humans do. But we're now being told that the dog is making him kill, not his human side.
Right, and it's such a contradiction that doesn't make sense. Because he's not really doing any of this to protect himself. I mean, I guess he did think that Khan was going to shoot him, the Wanchang doll. But everybody else who came before, they only want to shoot him because he has, you know, because of the body count at this point.
I mean, the first guy that died, Jake.
Right.
I mean, the two Chinese guys probably provoked him. But, like, Jake, I mean, was just in his house with his dog. I mean, like, what was Jake doing? So Scully is trailing Detweiler. I feel like we don't get to see enough of Scully follow suspects in the X-Files. I feel like I could see her, you know, like slunk down low in the car, like driving, following Detweiler. Mulder doesn't seem in any way concerned about Scully's safety, like chasing Detweiler when Detweiler has killed everyone he's come across practically.
Well, Scully is the most badass person he knows, so it's okay, Clara. She's got this.
I mean, he did leave her alone with an alien bounty hunter like a couple seasons
there
ago.
There you go.
So.
It's all right.
Mulder at his desk. This is the like last scene. And he seems sad and tired. And then so Scully goes in and asks if he's okay. She says it's not your fault. And he sort of says he doesn't feel responsible, but then he does claim that he does feel responsible for Karen's death. And then Scully is incredibly sympathetic and empathic, talking about how like they were two kindred souls.
Yeah.
And I'm like, bit late now, bitch. Like... like she's dead. Now you're gonna talk about like you never talk ill of the dead, right? But like still, this is not appropriate. Like you didn't treat her very well when she was alive. Like
it kind of reminds me, and I'm sure people will talk about it when they get to that episode. But when Diana Fowley dies, she spends this, you know, all of season six pretty much hating Diana, and then Diana dies, and she goes, "She was your friend, and I understand that," and she's very nice about it. And it's just so weird. But yeah, I guess, what are you going to say? You can't speak ill of the dead. So what else can she say?
I mean, I guess she could say, I wish I was a bit nicer to it while she was alive. But she's probably not going to say that either. So Scully sort of leaves, asks Mulder if he'd be okay. And then Mulder's like, yeah, I'll be fine. And Scully leaves.
Oh,
and then,
can I just say?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Before she leaves, she asks Mulder if he's going to go home, which is a nice little bookend to the beginning where she asks if he's going home, and this time he says yes, that he's just finishing up.
And I mean, in my view, I'm like, take him out to dinner.
Aww.
Like, you know, I mean, cheer him up, and you know, you were jealous, you might as well spend more time with him. Anyway,
I like where this is going.
fanfic territory. Yep. So Mulder sees there's a package that's been delivered to him, and he looks, and it's from Karen. And it's a long cylinder package, and he opens it up, and it's her I Want to Believe poster, which she sent to him. Which makes me wonder, did she write a will where she put Mulder in the will saying, I want him to get this poster? Or did she know that she was going to die, or that it was going to end this way, and send him the poster preemptively? We'll never know. But he's now got his poster back, his I Want to Believe, or a new I Want to Believe poster, and he sticks it up. And there's a nice little moment there where he puts the poster up, and then he sort of leans back in his chair and looks at the poster. And there's this kind of lovely little piece of music where he's sort of contemplating the belief poster.
And it's all done very ceremoniously. He opens it up. You don't see what it is. He starts putting in the tacks. You only see him, but you don't see what he's tacking up. And yeah, now his office is complete. So, you know, he leans back. You see what it is. And it's his office again. It's the X-Files. We're back to where we should be.
See, I really liked the ending. I thought the ending was a good ending. I like that. There was an alternative ending, which was also written, which was that after this little scene here, there would be another scene, which would be Officer Khan in hospital, slowly recovering, and there would be a nurse with him, and the nurse would leave and like pull a curtain across his bed or something, and then she would leave, and then he'd open his eyes, and his eyes would glow red.
Yeah.
I like that idea as well. I guess it's not essential, but I do kind of like that
idea. It's a very season six. No, I'm sorry. It's a very X-Files ending to it, leaving it a little open. Because, you know, if we don't have that ending, then we think, well, the Wan Chang Dol is now extinct. You have that, and maybe there's something more to investigate. I mean, they'll probably never go back to it, but it is a very X-Files ending. Though I do like the I want to believe ending. It's very sweet.
And it also, it's kind of nice. It means that, I think if Officer Khan becomes the Wan Chang Dol, then it's almost like Karen's sacrifice is kind of meaningless. Whereas this one feels a little bit like she took on the dog and she went down with it, but she took the dog down right. with her and then she gave Mulder a gift. And I think that's kind of a sweet ending.
Agreed.
Would you change your rating now that we've talked about it? Or is it still a 4 out of 10?
Maybe I'm down to 3.5. I don't know. No. Okay. So it made me very uncomfortable. I'm still at a 4 because I feel like there is so much to dissect about the way Scully acted, even if all you really boil it down to is that maybe someone doesn't know how to write women talking about jealousy. Even if you just boil it down to that, we talked about it a lot and tried to dissect it from, you know, everywhere, I guess. So for that, I'll stay at a 4. It's not getting any higher. It can only get lower. It's not a great episode. I'm sorry.
It can only get lower. So we do have some mailbag comments from the X-Cast, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast fan group on Facebook. And a few of the comments that, so there's lots of comments about this one. So
interesting.
I'm afraid I'm not going to read out everybody's comment, but I might summarize. I might not read all comments out in full because it's going to take a while, but I'll summarise a bit about what everybody said. So, Seanette Scott has said, so much wasted opportunity here. I still don't quite understand what this episode was trying to say, but it felt like the whole Scully is jealous subplot didn't really do any favours. And then Michael Little has said a comment, which I think is also interesting in light of what we've talked about. He said, Jeff Bell is terrible at writing women.
Hmm.
Which, so the other episodes that Jeff Bell's done, you know, I mean, I don't remember them. I think, well, The Rain King, some of the female character in The Rain King is intensely annoying.
Yes.
So maybe he is bad at writing women. I'm not sure I'd make that statement, but he's definitely bad at writing two women in this particular episode. So it's interesting that other people have noticed that. So AJ Black, Tony Black, has said, it's quite amazing really how season six started with quite format-breaking innovative episodes. And then in the second half, you have an episode so dull, formulaic and bland. It would put you to sleep even in season one. And he's right. Yeah. I did fall asleep. A waste of a great Andrew Robinson. That's yeah. true. Melinda Kalea's performance is almost Jane Atkinson in Fearful Symmetry levels of grating too. I didn't find Melinda Kalea so badly, but, you know, half a point for Mulder getting his poster back.
Okay. That's fair.
So I think we're supposed to think that Tony would maybe make this a 0.5 out of 10.
And that's fair. I get that.
Yeah, and I agree with him. I do think it is a waste of Andrew Robinson, who could definitely do a lot more with that role. Carl Neer has said, the only positive thing I remember about this episode was the inclusion of the talented Andrew Robinson. It's too bad his talents were wasted on a rather boring and uninspired episode that reminds me more of Shapes than it should.
Yes, I agree.
So, is Shapes a better episode than this? Or are they equally as bad as each other? Or is this one better than Shapes?
I like Shapes better. There's an atmosphere to it that I will put on in October just because it gives me this kind of It's not a Halloween episode by any means, but it gives me this Halloween feel, if that makes any sense. And I don't know why. I can't, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the dark scenes, but there's just something about it that I like much more than this one.
Well, so isn't there a scene in Shapes where one of the characters like morphs into a wolf and like his teeth kind of get pointy and he's all sweaty and stretched? And see, I actually found that kind of, I find that kind of creepy, as opposed to, I don't know, I just felt husky with glowing red eyes does not do it for
they're
me.
They're too cute. They're so cute. Yeah, although I will say cultural insensitivity on both episodes, Shapes and this one.
No, totally.
Specifically for the atmosphere of it, for the feel, I will pop that on. I watched this four times in preparation. I've watched Alpha four times in preparation for this.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. A lot of it was stop and start with the kids around. So I felt like I really needed to get the feel of this episode. And I don't know if I'll be putting this episode on for a very long time. Very long.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I don't think I'm going to be watching this for a long time. So Chris Knowles says that Garrick is one of my favorite all-time characters. So there's that.
Yes.
But he says, I also know the guy who this character is based on. So the guy that Detweiler is based on. And he's as big of an asshole as he's portrayed. So, I mean, Chris, tell us who this guy is based on. Like, is he based on some sort of dog behavior? I don't know. I mean, I need to know.
Yeah, we need more information there. Spill the tea, please.
Yeah. Come on, Chris. Some of you know I am the king of all dogs, so it's hard for me to hate this. So, I agree with Chris. If you're a fan of dogs, there's some cute dogs. Not going to lie. Yeah. It's always a win. Adam Silver said this might be my least favorite episode for its pure banality. I'm with you there, Adam. Heather Ben says this is the first episode I skip in a full rewatch.
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty impressive because Space is probably, I never watch Space. So
Mulder is, like, this is not a Space episode, but Mulder is so cute in it. The end. I won't say more.
That's true. So I mean, I would also miss, is it Babylon? There are episodes. I mean, but I agree with Heather. I probably wouldn't watch this again for a long time. Andrew Levitt has said, Alpha gets a lot of flack, and while most of it's deserved, there are some positive elements in this episode. Karen is an interesting parallel to Mulder, showing us how he might have become reclusive had it not been for Scully, which is something I want to believe, the film I want to believe, briefly touched on. The dark atmosphere of the episode is a welcome return, and it's great to see Mulder get a new I Want to Believe poster after the previous one was destroyed. I like the rare animal causes havoc idea, but it's definitely not played out to its potential. And there are some pretty cringeworthy jokes in the episode, and the generic nature of the procedural story leaves viewers feeling underwhelmed. Overall, I think it's an underrated but still very average episode.
Well, that's a very good review. I like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea as well, showing that a parallel between Karen and Mulder, that Mulder could be more reclusive if he wasn't, you know, in a relationship, working friendship, possible love relationship with Scully. And there is a point to that, isn't it? Like, Scully is kind of the thing that keeps Mulder human and interacting with the world.
I like that.
So, Andrew, good point. Chandru Ravidan says, Alpha is not a good episode. The subplot of Scully's bizarre jealousy and protectiveness for Mulder doesn't work whatsoever. We've talked about that already. And a shout out to the dudes in the teaser for being some of the dumbest characters in the history of the show. Who the hell shakes a crate slightly and assumes the animal inside must be dead?
Agreed. That was so bad.
Chandru, we're with you there. Mm-hmm. So Russell Hugo had some very good comments. So one of the things he said was he couldn't remember the episode, so he had to rewatch it. So he likes the red eye effect on the dog, and he really agrees with you there. He thinks it can feel a bit threatening. And he also says he doesn't remember the dog being so small. The dog's smaller than he remembers it.
Not a threatening dog.
Yeah, he says it's weird that they don't interview anyone else on the ship. They don't interview any of the crew. That's a good point. He says it's the moodiest vet that he's ever seen. I thought the vet was quite nice.
The vet?
Maybe he means the veterinary surgery. He says, I know the X-Files always amps up the mood in a lot of locations, but a foggy vet with pink-hued lights where there are patrons. Oh, he means the veterinary. He means the building.
Oh, okay.
The building is lit really strangely. That's true, actually. When you go into veterinary surgeries, they are like fluorescently lit. Do you know what I mean? Like hospitals.
Right.
It's true. It's very dark in that veterinary surgery.
That makes sense. Yeah.
You wonder that he can even do surgery with that little light.
But then how will it be creepy? Please.
One of the things he says is confusing is Karen's plan was to lure the dog to her to jump out of the window and hope he gets impaled on the fence.
That's funny.
So the real bad things that he doesn't like are the weird mistrust and jealousy with Scully, and Karen does not work for him. Scully comes across as a bit of a bully, and I think that's true, especially when Scully diagnoses her with lupus, which is really invasive. He says, I know the script justifies Scully's skepticism, but she doesn't really have any basis for it according to the plotting until we see Karen and the shapeshifter meet in the hospital. This entire twist that Karen was in on it, it seems horribly clumsy. That's true. Maldus is worried about the fact that he believed Karen too quickly, and that he says that at the very end of the episode, he was believing her very quickly. And he's confused about that. He says, why? A, she told him about the case that was real and verified by the cops. B, she's a published and renowned dog expert. Why wouldn't you be more likely to trust her about dog-related cases? It's a good point. That's a line that makes no sense. Also, him believing her didn't mean that she died. Anyway. He says, is it better than Shapes? And he says he thinks it is, partly because of the dogs.
Oh, okay.
There's a running theme here that people like the dogs, but not the episode.
The dogs were cute. I'm sorry. What can I say?
Michael Little does not like the dog puns and the jokes. I'm with you there, Michael.
They were a little rough,
And Deanna says something here. Deanna Ferreri says something here, which I think is actually really important. She says the worst part of the episode for her is when Scully seems to insinuate that Karen having lupus was somehow her choice, and also means that she's involved in a crime or something sinister. It's just so absurd. And that is true. That's a really bad moment in the episode. And then Katie at the very end, last person to comment is Katie Doe, who says, I really need to rewatch this one to have any info, to enough info to comment, but I don't really want to. Katie, don't worry, we did it for you.
Don't do it.
We took one for the team, Katie. You don't need to watch this.
No.
Just listen to the podcast.
And then it'll reaffirm that you don't want to watch it.
You might want to listen to us. We're more entertaining than the podcast. Not the podcast, sorry. We're more entertaining than the episode, I would hope. So, Annie, I want to say thank you for coming on the XCast today to talk about Alpha, to talk about, mythical dog men and Scully's insane behaviour.
It was a pleasure.
I'm glad. And so is there anything you'd like to promote, or where can we find you online?
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at AnnieXFlowers, and you can also listen to my lovely voice narrate fanfic at Audio Fanfic Pod, or at Audio Fanfic Podcast, and you can find that on iTunes or SoundCloud.
So my name is Clara Cook, and you can find me on Twitter at ClaraJeanMC. You can find the XCast on Twitter at @TheX_cast. And you can join the XCast Basement podcast fan group on Facebook to discuss XCast episodes and the X-Files. You can find the XCast on Instagram at @TheXCastPod. So join us next time for more Mulder and Scully's adventures. And in the meantime, as always, just remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The time is now. A Millennium Podcast.
I hate Hollywood. I hate the way these stories are told. It's everything. They hit the same beats. They hit the same rhythms. It's kind of like, reminds me of a blues thing, where it's like, well, a lot of people love the blues, but, it just, I realize that it's everything has the same underlying structure, everything is 12 bar, 1-4-5, pentatonic, everything is following the same core elements, and it just gets exhausting after a while.
It does. I remember going to see Gary Moore, and as much as I enjoy music, I enjoy going to see bands and things, and after about, I'd say, 30 minutes, I was like, I need to check out.
we buy records.
How much would you sell this record for on Discogs? Now, the record in question is Microsoft DOS on a vinyl album, which you can actually boot a PC with.
You've got to be kidding.
I'm not kidding. Does this sound bringing back any memories? From what I can gather, it looks like they've done it as a hobby project. But if it was commercially available...
All it needs is an incredibly vaporwave sleeve. And I guarantee that hipsters would pay a fortune for that.
We are Starfleet.
So this was kind of a nice callback to the elements that were used on TOS. And it really stuck out to me. And it just, as I keep saying every week, you know, there's always a little give and take, right? Where the writers bring in this element from TOS or TNG or from Voyager, and it fits into the Discovery realm.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they didn't draw out Georgiou seeking medical attention for her issue. I was a little worried.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.